Hey everyone, if you love listening to Curbsiders and want to enhance the experience, then now is a great time to join the Curbsiders Patreon with new annual memberships where you can save 10% off the monthly rate. You'll have the option to hear all the episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes. You can sign up at patreon.com/curbsiders. This is a great way to use that CME money that's probably burning a hole in your pocket, plus support the show so we can keep bringing you clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, mini-series like Teach and Addiction Medicine, our Digest newsletter, and of course, expand our video content. So join the Cashlack family today at patreon.com/curbsiders.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
Hi, Carolyn. How are you?
Good. How's your day been?
You know, it's wrapping up, which is fine by me.
I have to say, I had an amazing burrito today. I'm pumped to record. And this is a topic we're really excited to talk about. So welcome back, everyone, to the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, our mini-series on substance use disorders. I'm Carolyn Chan, and tonight I am joined by Dr. Kat Mullins. And on tonight, we're really stoked to talk about opioid use disorder in pregnancy. And this episode, it's just not going to disappoint. We have the incredible Dr. Mishka Terplan. But before we get too into our episode, Kat, do you want to just remind the audience what we do on the show?
Absolutely. So we are the addiction medicine podcast that uses expert interviews to demystify common addiction medicine topics, reduce stigma, and inspire listeners to be fierce advocates for all individuals who use substances. And a reminder that most episodes are available for free CME credit through the VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account.
And a very special thanks to the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM, who have partnered with us to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine miniseries. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction medicine faculty, trainees, and they're really dedicated to training and supporting the next generation of academic addiction medicine leaders. So whether you're an addiction med doc preparing for the ABPM board exam, or you're a physician just in practice looking to learn more about the field, ACAM offers a couple of self-study products that can help meet your needs. They have the professional practice bundle, which includes access to 86 self-assessment modules that provide CME, as well as 46 didactic lecture recordings. ACAM's board prep bundle also includes access to those great lectures, along with its nearly 200 item question bank and its addiction e-practice test. So to learn more about these and other products, be sure to check out acam.org.
So we have a fantastic conversation with our guest tonight that I'm so excited about. So our guest is Dr. Mishka Terplan, who's board certified in both obstetrics and gynecology, as well as in addiction medicine. His primary clinical research, public health, and advocacy interests lie along the intersections of reproductive and behavioral health. He is the medical director and senior research scientist at Friends Research Institute, as well as adjunct faculty at the University of California, San Francisco, where he is a substance use warmline clinician for the National Clinician Consultation Center. Dr. Terplan has active grant funding and has published extensively on health inequities, discrimination, and access to treatment. He has spoken at local high schools and before the United States Congress and has participated in federal and international expert panels, primarily on issues related to gender, reproduction, and addiction. So tonight, he gives us a few pearls about how important it is to initiate medication for opioid use disorder during pregnancy and get somebody to a stable dose, how that is actually safer for mom and baby. And he talks us through how to navigate child welfare reporting, especially how we tend to over-report, and how to advocate for our patients when they are in this position. So I'm so excited, and let's get to it.
And I just want to remind folks, I think, Kat, you produced an episode with us last season and helped us review a ton of episodes. But can you just remind the audience who you are and give a one-liner about yourself?
Oh, sure. I never did do a one-liner before. So I am a 33-year-old primary care addiction and HIV doctor living in Brooklyn, New York. And newly, I'm the proud renter of an apartment with a backyard that includes a garden. That's a big deal around these parts. So now that our tulips are blooming, I basically spend all my free time looking at them.
Is it just flowers, or are you growing vegetables, anything else?
I just sprouted a few tomato plants. So the season is young. We'll see what happens, but very excited.
Look out, Will. Cat's going to have some fresh tomatoes.
Yeah, I'm never leaving my apartment again.
So let's kick it off. Hi, Mishka. It's so excited and we're so happy that you were able to come on the show today and we appreciate your time.
Well, thank you again so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
We'll go ahead and get started with a case. So this will be a case from Cashlack Memorial, like always. So Ms. H is a 32-year-old woman with a history of an opioid use disorder, not currently in treatment, who presents to your office after discovering 3 weeks ago that she's pregnant and is approximately 12 weeks. So she's in her first trimester. She has no medical history, currently takes no medicines at home, and she reports sniffing 5 bags of heroin per day. She feels excited about the pregnancy and is anxious about her use affecting her baby, but she's been struggling to cut down on her use. She says she tried to quit cold turkey a number of times, but always felt too uncomfortable and then returned to using. She's hesitant to try medication because she doesn't want her baby to be born addicted. So, Mishka, I'm curious, first of all, how can opioid use and opioid withdrawal impact the health both of the pregnant woman and of fetuses?
Well, I think to be like really general at first, that they're in this whole space, this like intersection between, you know, behavioral health in general, substance use and use disorder in particular, and reproductive health in general and pregnancy in particular, we tend to really overstate what the risks of chemical exposures are. So, you know, you asked about things like birth defects, right? Opioids, whether it be illicitly, you know, manufactured synthetic opioids, you know, illicitly procured heroin, prescription opioids, whether they're used or misused, though they are not teratogenic, or whether it's medications for opioid use disorder, they are not teratogenic. They do not cause, birth defects. And when we think about life, let's say, from the perspective of the fetus, right? The fetus does not know if the substance to which it's exposed is legal or illegal, prescribed, used as prescribed, natural or synthetic. Those are distinctions that make no sense from the perspective of the fetus and fetal health. Yet we apply that legal classification, you know, to the biology of pregnancy. We assume, you know, that things that are illegal are going to be more harmful. And that's actually not true. From the perspective of teratogens, things that cause birth defects, of the hundreds of thousands of described chemicals in the universe, only a handful are teratogenic. And those that are primarily prescribed medications, and a couple are legal substances, in particular alcohol, which is, you know, the leading cause of preventable intellectual disability in the United States. Right? The harm of illegal substances is their illegality, that you have to engage in a criminal economy to obtain it, that you're putting your, you know, Section 8 housing and employment, you know, at risk by using it. For people who are pregnant, that you're at risk, and we're going to talk about this, I'm sure, where you're at risk of losing your child to, you know, the family policing system because of illegal substance use. So the primary risks are social and contextual and historical and not chemical.
I really appreciate that perspective. I think that we lose that so easily when we're thinking about pregnancy, and it's just, that's great.
And, you know, we see this all the time, right? On TV and movies and pop culture, and these stereotypes just kind of keep getting perpetuated, which is so frustrating to see. And I'm curious, like, as you said too, the emphasis is too, we want to help folks who are seeking treatment, you know, get treatment. Do you have a sense of like what the burden is of women who are pregnant with like untreated opioid use disorder? Is it large in this country, small in this country?
Yeah. So, you know, in general, like from NISDA, the National Survey of Drug Use and Health data, only 11% of people who meet criteria for a use disorder report receipt of any treatment in the past year. And that's a number that is unchanged in the past several decades, unchanged after probably $1 trillion+ spent, you know, by NIDA to fund research in this space. And it's shameful. And you can contrast that with any other chronic disease. you know, the proportion. I don't know the exact number, the proportion of people with depression who report receipt of treatment in the past year is 75% or greater. In pregnancy, from the National Survey of Drug Use and Health data, self-reported receipt of treatment is slightly higher. It's the highest for opioid use disorder. It's about a third of people who meet criteria for OUD who are also pregnant report receipt of any treatment. Mm. But, is the treatment they receive standard of care, evidence-based, much less person-centered, which is something we actually don't really evaluate well. Amongst people who are admitted to publicly funded drug treatment programs in the United States under the Behavioral Health Authority supervision, so that's some 90% of drug treatment admissions to specialty addiction services who are pregnant with OUD, only 50% report receipt of medication, which is the standard of care. And even within the population of pregnant people with opioid use disorder, there are marked racial inequities, both in terms of odds of receiving any medication, as well as then really the quality of medication received. There are data from the state of Massachusetts that demonstrate that Black pregnant people compared to white non-Hispanic pregnant people have 0.4 times the odds of any medication receipt. And there are data from a single program in Philadelphia that look at the mean methadone dose at the time of delivery. It's about 145 milligrams for white people and less than 100, about 99 for Black people. So there are marked racial inequities within that system that is in which most people aren't getting treated.
Mm. It's so sobering. It's so jarring. It makes me angry and frustrated that this happens. And that's why, in part why we're glad you're here, so you can teach us a little bit more about how we can care for these patients the best. So I'm curious, say this patient is presenting to your office and is pregnant and is requesting treatment for opioid use disorder. What's your initial approach? How are you sort of structuring this conversation? What are you thinking about?
I think really the first thing is to reflect back to them, the journey that they have gone through to get to that moment, and to try to begin to establish, a strong therapeutic alliance. More importantly, to really just to welcome them and to hope that in time they might feel welcomed in that space. That if they're interested in medication, let's start the medication. Let's have a conversation about which medication that probably I would ask, what has been your experience with medications in the past? What do you know about methadone or buprenorphine? And take it from there.
What medications are available for opioid use disorder during pregnancy?
Well, as there's three medications that we use in general for OUD: methadone, buprenorphine, naltrexone. Methadone and buprenorphine are the safest, most effective medications for opioid use disorder in pregnancy. Naltrexone, it's not that it's unsafe. I think that it's just that the evidence base is not nearly as established as for the other two. Safety, probably you could say it's safe. The effectiveness, and certainly compared to the other medications, is way, way less known. So it's not recommended. That doesn't mean we wouldn't. Well, let me actually back up, because there's two scenarios when we're talking about pregnancy. One is medication initiation and the other is continuation. So for medication initiation, I think it's safe to say really, generally speaking, naltrexone would not be recommended, for medication initiation. Now, if somebody becomes pregnant while taking naltrexone, that's different. And so the two most safest, most effective medications are methadone, buprenorphine. Methadone, we have data in pregnancy from the 1970s to the present. And for buprenorphine, we have data from, over 20 years now.
And for buprenorphine, does that include the injectable form?
Oh, great question. Again, I'll mark this distinction between medication initiation and medication continuation. So the excipient in the extended release formulation that's available on the market today, the monthly injection, brand name Sublocade, is in animal studies, is associated with reproductive harms. At doses that are, I can't remember exactly, but it's at least two, but more like, depending on the outcome, 4 or 8 times what the human dose is. So that would be like a pin of caution that should be disclosed to the person who might be interested in it. Second is that due to the physiologic changes of pregnancy, in particular, sort of like an increased metabolism of medications, sometimes people will need an increased dose or more likely actually split dosing of either methadone or buprenorphine in pregnancy. And there's only 2 lanes for the extended release formulation, and they're monthly. And that's a time period of medication adjustment that does not align with those physiologic changes of pregnancy. So one could supplement on top, you know, with sublingual buprenorphine. But in and of itself, so I would say, and this is really my opinion, that, you know, I would steer away, generally speaking, from initiation of Sublocade. If somebody becomes pregnant on Sublocade, that's, again, a different conversation, and you're weighing the risks of, you know, changing medication for the risks of, you know, the unknown of continuation. And if you have somebody who's stable on medication and you change their medication, the best you can hope for is the same. You can't make an asymptomatic person better, but you can make them worse. And so I think it's, you know, we need to be careful about medication, just, you know, changing just because of pregnancy or just because of postpartum or, you know, just because, you know, something else.
I love that point about the split dosing, and you can't really do that when it's just a once a month injection. So that's really interesting. I just hadn't thought about it that way.
Now, there is another extended release formulation that's weekly that is under being studied. There's a clinical trial underway right now in pregnancy. And the excipient is alcohol. It's a small amount, unlikely to be of, you know, like harm to the fetus, but it is alcohol. And it has more dosing options. So I think weekly adjustments fit actually also with the pattern of prenatal care. And having more options, you know, to increase dose if needed might make more sense.
And just sort of taking us back a little bit. So it sounds like methadone and buprenorphine, sublingual, these are the meds we really have the most experience with. How would you counsel and discuss sort of the risks and benefits of each option with the patient?
I mean, really, this should be led by the patient. That and also by the structural realities of where you practice. You know, initiating methadone in an inpatient context to somebody who in an environment where there are no OTPs in the community makes no long-term sense. So you definitely want to start something that people are able to continue, primarily because it's what they want, and also because the universe will allow them to have what they want that way. So really, it depends on people's experiences with medications in the past. I would say primarily it's like people's experiences with medications in the past.
I think that's a great point to really make sure the plan is feasible, because if it's not feasible, it's just not going to happen. So in terms of some of the research, you know, we have the large mother trial. I don't know if you're able to talk about like some of those results and sort of what we see from the physician perspective in terms of some of the pros and cons.
Yeah, so the mother study was a randomized controlled trial of methadone versus buprenorphine, the primary outcome being neonatal abstinence syndrome, and it was a non-inferiority trial, which gets missed. So, and it you know, really the primary, the 2 primary findings, which are not necessarily of as much relevance now as they might have been then, honestly. So one, was that people who were randomized to the buprenorphine arm had a greater attrition than people who were randomized to the methadone arm. Attrition in the buprenorphine arm was, I think, 30%, and it was maybe 15% in the methadone arm. And that was probably not because of buprenorphine per se. The people who left the study continued with medication, primarily with methadone. But their initiation protocol was perhaps more gradual than what most people would do today. So it probably reflected that practice rather than something pharmacologic. The main outcome is that although the likelihood of the infant developing withdrawal was the same in both arms, the infants amongst those who developed withdrawal, those who had been exposed to buprenorphine, the severity and duration of the withdrawal was less, measured by total amount of morphine that the infant received, measured by days in the hospital.
Okay, so the numbers were similar between the two groups in terms of how many actually developed withdrawal, but the severity differed between methadone and buprenorphine.
Correct. Now, since then, this has been looked at, you know, in other contexts, in, you know, cohorts, not necessarily in RCTs, and as well as retrospectively. And those data might, you know, suggest that withdrawal, certainly the severity and duration is less for buprenorphine versus methadone. And maybe in some data indicate that infants are less likely overall to develop withdrawal if they're buprenorphine exposed versus methadone exposed. But this does not mean that buprenorphine should be the first choice, in my opinion. Right? The mother study was a non-inferiority trial, first of all. That's the only RCT. And second of all, like, there's something weird that happens, I think, with physician mindsets sometimes. For a long time, we only had one option. Then we have two options. And our question is, which one is the first one? Which one is the best one? Rather than, you know, each are different and we can provide more person-centered care with more options. And so I'm a little discouraged that some of the discussion is around first line versus, you know, second line. I don't think the evidence supports that. And I think philosophically, it's a very narrow view of the world. There's many illness states where we have more than two medications, and we you know, some are better in certain contexts, and, you know, blah blah blah, and we're not thinking there's got to only be one.
And I think it's important too to point out that both of these medicines are incredibly effective if patients mm-hmm. are interested in them, right? Like, we know they prevent overdoses, decrease mortality, morbidity in the mother. And
yeah,
that's what
oh, yeah. Yeah. People whose, like, opioid use disorder is treated with medication deliver at term, you know, normal birth weight infants, healthy term infants, which is really, you know, like, a goal of obstetric care. And medications, both, there's not a meaningful difference in terms of gestational age or birth weight or overall, like, that type of population health between those two medications.
And I don't know if you hear this much, Kat, in your practice, but I hear this all the time. I don't like using the word, like, addicted per se, but, you know, this idea where somebody comes to you and they're like, I'm worried my baby is going to be born, like, quote unquote, addicted, which,
yes,
I think
so
is
much.
Really outdated terminology. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. it's out there. And I'm curious, what do you say to patients who are sort of using that terminology, and how do you reframe that?
Well, sometimes it's the same thing that I would say to my colleagues or a reporter or a legislator, right? So the term addicted baby is an example of stigma. It's based on ignorance. It's a conflation, actually, of dependence with use disorder, right? It's actually a really good way to teach a medical student, the difference between dependence and addiction is to talk about, you know, neonatal abstinence syndrome. So dependence is physiologic, and when cessation of exposure leads to withdrawal. Addiction is a behavioral condition. It's brain centered, affects the whole body, but the symptoms are behaviors. Think craving, compulsive use, continued use despite adverse consequences. Those are behaviors that make absolutely no sense for a newborn. Addiction's a chronic condition. Chronic conditions really can't be present at birth. So the term is misleading and it's stigmatizing, and it's to be pushed back at when you hear it amongst colleagues. For patients, I go through the same spiel, that this is not how we define addiction. This is addiction, just like everything I just said. Your newborn might experience withdrawal after it's born. It will be observed for a while and evaluated. If it does exhibit signs of withdrawal, neonatal abstinence syndrome is expected and treatable without any measurable long-term consequences in terms of child neurobehavioral development. People are legitimately worried about their infant undergoing withdrawal. I mean, we have only sort of touched on this, but this is all the whole guilt and shame and sort of intersectional discriminations that happen around drug use and pregnancy and birth. And they're legitimately worried about their infant, you know, quote unquote, suffering from withdrawal. And so we can talk about ways to minimize that. One of the most interesting things about neonatal abstinence syndrome is that it's not only the opioid. Opioids are like a necessary but insufficient cause of newborn withdrawal. We've observed for decades that there's not a relationship between dose of methadone and now dose of buprenorphine and presence or absence of withdrawal and much less severity and duration. There are other intrauterine exposures that relate to the symptomatology of newborn withdrawal. Prescribed medications, gabapentin, benzodiazepines, cigarettes. There's a dose-dependent cigarette, number cigarette-dependent relationship between, there's a relationship between the number of cigarettes smoked per day and severity and duration of withdrawal, which can be a very good way of talking about smoking cessation or just cutting back in pregnancy. People are worried about withdrawal. Even if you cut back one cigarette a day, that'll lessen it. But withdrawal also relates to the postpartum environment, right? Infants who are separated from their mothers, placed in a neonatal intensive care unit, have withdrawal that's more severe, longer duration, and et cetera. So promoting attachment, skin-to-skin contact, breastfeeding, breast milk, what's called rooming in, allowing the mom and infant to recover together, and really placing the mother at the center of the postpartum care plan, which is part of what's called Eat, Sleep, Console, which is a paradigm of newborn dyadic care, those lessen the severity and duration of withdrawal as well. And finally, there are data that show that, you know, methylation of the mu opioid receptor, so an epigenetic phenomenon, is probably what determines, to some extent, the expression of withdrawal far more than, you know, the opioid itself. So all of those things, some of those are things we can work on individually with a patient, right? The smoking cessation, breastfeeding, and some of it is structural within the hospital, getting these kids out of the NICU and keeping them together with their, mother.
So it sounds like part of what we can really do is encourage women to be on a dose that feels appropriate to them without the concern that that's going to hurt their baby. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so the reason, think about like untreated opioid use disorder, right? people, your case example, they were using opioids, heroin, fentanyl, I don't remember, like 5 times a day. And you know, when they're using it, they're not getting high. They're just less sick than they were. They're barely feeling normal, right? So they're undergoing multiple episodes of withdrawal a day. But so is their pregnancy, right? So is the fetus. And it's actually those multiple episodes of withdrawal that confer the quote-unquote risk, right? It's stress leads to premature activation of the hypothalamic pituitary axis, which leads to a cascade of events that can culminate in preterm birth. So just as the goal of medications for opioid use disorder in general, we use the term stabilization, right? So too in pregnancy. By stabilizing the pregnant person, we stabilize the pregnancy, we stabilize the intrauterine environment. And there are no longer those rapid fluctuations of withdrawal. And these are medications that, generally speaking, are long-acting. When, you know, dosed correctly, people don't feel intoxicated, they don't feel sick, they feel normal. And that sort of stability of the medication really allows the pregnancy to grow normally.
I think that's a great point. And I like to tell my patients who are worried, who have this idea, well, I'm going to stay in the lowest dose possible because that's the safest. And really just sort of correcting that information, being like, no, it's actually a lot more complicated than that. It's whatever dose that makes you feel the best, that treats your symptoms and your management is what's best, because the absolute number doesn't matter because there's already so much individual variation.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And there's all this talk in medicine, right, of overtreatment, in particular, like in cancer care and stuff like that. There might be forms of overtreatment in addiction medicine, but certainly when it comes to medications in general and medications for opioid use disorder and pregnancy in particular, it's a space of undertreatment.
Yeah, I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about split dosing, because that concept came up before. So what does that mean? What could that look like in pregnancy? When do we think about it?
It's safe to say that everybody who's pregnant becomes a more rapid metabolizer of methadone. And also buprenorphine, although perhaps slightly less so. So what that means is that there's more rapid clearance of the medication. So what might have held somebody for 24 hours is only holding them for 18 or 12 or sometimes even less. So when you think about the pharmacokinetic curve, it's going to go up the same way, but it's going to drop down more quickly. And there are data, both for methadone and in particular more recently for buprenorphine, that show daily dosing that people are spending a majority of the 24 hours after medication administration with buprenorphine levels less than 2 nanograms, sometimes even less than 1 per deciliter. So that's at a threshold where they might be experiencing withdrawal and they certainly might be experiencing cravings. If you just increase the AM dose, right, all you're doing is making the curve go up higher in the beginning, but it's going to come down, kind of the area under the curve doesn't shift that much with an increase in AM dosing. Well, you increase the area under the curve greater by splitting the dose 2 times a day, 3 times a day, 4 times a day, et cetera. And so the principle, I think, would be that, it's person-centered. Everybody is different. So it definitely does not mean that everybody needs a dose increase. You could argue that everybody in pregnancy should begin at least BID dosing, or maybe everybody in general, but it means sort of individualized, asking people about withdrawal, but certainly about cravings, certainly if somebody uses, then whether or not they experience any effect, all of those would be indications that they're under-medicated at that point in time. And I would split dose before I did a dose increase.
Mm. And I think this is the one scenario in methadone clinics where it's actually pretty easy to get a split dose. So
And we're hoping that will become even easier, like with the relaxed regulations that we're seeing. And there's a bit of a pilot program in the state of Washington to just split dose everybody who's pregnant, you know, from the get-go that we're working out. So I think there'll be, and then there'll be some good data ultimately that can show both acceptability, safety, and effectiveness of split dose regimens.
So another question that has come up in practice about dosing for buprenorphine, do you prefer the mono product or is the combined buprenorphine and naloxone okay?
So the original studies were done with the mono product, and when stated in professional society guidance documents, most of the time they just say buprenorphine, but sometimes they still will say mono product preferred. And that's not because of any described risks or harms of the combination product. That was because that was what was used in the mother study. So the guidance documents lag. The professional society guidance documents lag. Today, there is at least one systematic review that compares the mono product to the combination product in pregnancy, and there is no difference in outcomes. Both should be considered safe and effective. Now, which one to choose? Generally speaking, that which is most available, which is the combination product. My concern with initiation of the mono product in pregnancy is the subsequent transition, you know, to the combination product in the postpartum period. You're taking somebody who's stable in recovery on medication and changing the medication at a time postpartum where they're the most vulnerable for return to use, overdose, and overdose death. You're setting somebody up, perhaps, you know, for failure. And that could be avoided if you just started the combination product. The second reason I think people moved away from the mono product, some people, was the observation that the mono product commands a higher street value. And not it's not that the patients were diverting it, but that patients who were in violent relationships, who were experiencing gender-based violence, were being, that their medication was being taken and sold by abusive partners, far more likely to be monoproduct than combination product. So that some of those observations were things that people began long, you know, 10 years ago to use the combination product in pregnancy. I would say the evidence has caught up with that practice and confirms, you know, safety and effectiveness of the combination product. All that being said, I think addiction medicine really should have a conversation about why we're putting naloxone into this medication in the first place.
Yes.
But I'll leave that aside.
We could probably spend 2 hours talking about that on a different episode. I don't know if people would want to listen to us talk about that for 2 hours, but we could do it.
I guess before we go on to the second part of the case here, how about other forms of support? So is there any psychosocial treatment that you would offer at this time?
That's a great question. So I'll just begin first just with the evidence. And this is evidence in general, not specific to pregnancy. We know that the addition of behavioral health in randomized controlled trial settings to medication is either of no measurable benefit or really minimal benefit. So I usually flip that around, right? We should not withhold medication because somebody's not attending groups or in counseling or whatever. Clearly, engagement in, you know, behavioral health services is generally speaking a good thing. But we have to make those services available and really welcoming for pregnant and parenting people. And so the onus is on us to some extent to do that. So I think however people find support that it supports recovery, I support that. The content of the behavioral health care matters less than the person's engagement and continuation with it. The only exception for that is really contingency management, which is the one behavioral intervention which has shown a benefit for the treatment of substance use disorder in pregnancy.
Great. So our patient, Miss H, she opts for buprenorphine. She starts it. She tolerates it well. But today she says she's feeling really anxious about another aspect of her care because she's really worried. She's heard that babies have been taken away from mothers who use substances, and she's really worried that you or somebody else is going to report her to Child Protective Services. So I guess this question to you is what is required for clinicians who are caring for persons who are pregnant in terms of reporting the state Department of Children and Family, which is often called, I think, DCF in a lot of places.
Yeah. Well, first, her concern is legitimate. It's real. There has been a marked increase in child welfare reports, family separations, i.e. placing kids into foster care, and even the termination of parental rights in parallel with the opioid crisis.
Mishka gave us a ton of great insight into healthcare professionals' roles in reporting to Child Protective Services, also called CPS. He breaks down federal legislation known as CAPTA, or the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act. CAPTA requires healthcare professionals to notify a state agency, as well as develop a family care plan for each substance-affected infant. Now, CAPTA does not equate substance use during pregnancy with child abuse, but many states have taken this a step further and do classify substance use during pregnancy as child abuse. Despite this wording in CAPTA, there's wide variability in how states implement it. And you can familiarize yourself with your own state requirements in order to avoid overreporting and reach out to a local expert in your area if you have questions.
Remember that overreporting does carry its own risks. People who use drugs during pregnancy are more likely to be reported, and family separation carries its own harms. Children in the foster care system are more likely than children in the general population to experience abuse or neglect. Black and Indigenous parents are more likely to be reported and more likely to be separated from their families. There are persistent racial inequities in the termination of parental rights. For these reasons, Mishka highlights the importance of advocacy in improving state policies and reporting practices. The best intention of CAPTA is to collect anonymized data for redirection of resources. The best intention of the family care plan is to match the family with resources in order to avoid investigation or involvement of family policing systems. Yet, these good intentions are not implemented equitably at the state level.
He encourages us to remember that the CAPTA law was intended to be a surveillance tool, and Child Protective Services was intended to be a surveillance agency, not a service delivery organization. Ideally, the goal is to match families with needed services without involving a system of policing or conflating poverty with child abuse. Be familiar with your own local resources, as this can be a great way to advocate for your patients, since knowing your local landscape can help you avoid policing systems unless absolutely necessary.
It's also worth making it clear to the patient that even if you don't generate a CPS report, a Child Protective Services report, another member of the healthcare team still might.
I think it's important to be honest and to say that we can't control the flow of information to policing agencies from healthcare settings at this moment in time, and to recognize that that dynamic is getting worse. So why do health professionals report, or I would say over-report, which means a report in beyond what is legally mandated? And some of it is because they don't understand what the legal mandates are.
There is much work to be done, and individual clinicians must study their own state and local policies to better advocate for evidence-based practices and to avoid direct patient harm.
And there's a real role for hospitals to create transparent policies around reporting that share, you know, that are like share what the rights that our patients have and what they can expect from the process. So I think that that's a structural solution at the level of the hospital. I think we have individual responsibility, like you illustrated, in terms of sort of advocating and supporting in those specific contexts and following the person, you know, afterwards. And third, we have a professional responsibility, I think, you know, to advocate at the state level to undo punitive policies, to collaborate with community-based organizations as well as, you know, legal aid so that people can actually have, to prevent them from getting to court, and when they're there, to have adequate representation that reflects, you know, science that reflects, you know, their narrative through in recovery. To me, when to report, like, it would be something incredibly rare. And that would be like if the child or infant is at risk of imminent harm, not some conjectural future harm, not this is a person in extreme poverty and, you know, conflating neglect with poverty. Is there a risk of imminent harm? And is the behavior, i.e., let's say drug use, the causal factor for that imminent harm? And the answer for that is almost always, I mean, I would never, you know, going to be no. Because in this space too, there's this other assumption, right? It's baked into, you see it, you read it all the time, that people who use drugs in pregnancy are more likely to subsequently abuse or neglect their infants. And that bears some unpacking. There's only one systematic review on this topic. And they found people who use drugs in pregnancy were more likely to be reported to child welfare. That reflects this policy and over-reporting, you know, kind of environment. But the evidence to support, you know, substantiated abuse or maltreatment was negligible or absent, and the quality of the literature which exists in this topical area was poor. So over half of the states have statutes that equate using drugs in pregnancy with child abuse. And that's a statement that's, well, it's not a scientific statement. It's a tautology, right? It's something defined in reference to itself. It's not falsifiable. It's a statement of belief, not of science. And the belief is the belief of fetal rights. Because really, that is what I think underlies like most of these statutes, is sort of the elevation of fetal rights. And when you think about the pregnant person, and this is like a really kind of almost like a cruel way to think about things, like the unit of rights is fixed, right? So the only way you increase fetal rights is by decreasing the rights of the pregnant person.
And you just really effectively outlined the actual documented harms of reporting to both mom and baby. So I think we don't maybe think about that enough, but when we're thinking about even considering reporting and imminent risks, that's what we're weighing it against. We're weighing it against these very real, well-documented harms.
Right. And to clarify further, like, so there's that risk of early separation, which disrupts early childhood development, which is the most critical period in human life. But there's, and the risk to the parent, we know people like who have children removed are like more likely to return to use, overdose, and perhaps die of an overdose. And I don't know what the relative contribution of child welfare is to overdose deaths in the postpartum period, but overdose deaths are the leading or one of the leading, depending on the state, cause of maternal deaths in the United States.
This has been so helpful, and I hope our listeners are getting a lot out of this. I think just to continue on with our case a little bit, we're lucky Miss H stays in care, stays on medication, has a pretty uncomplicated pregnancy, and delivers a healthy infant. And she wants to know, is she able to breastfeed? You know, she wants to stay on buprenorphine, and is this something that's okay?
Yes, not just okay, but encouraged unless there's some other contraindication to breastfeeding. Breastfeeding promotes attachment and is associated with a decrease in the severity and duration of withdrawal. It's, you know, it's mother is the best medicine in more ways than that, but that reflects that old adage. And it's not, because there are metabolites of medications for opioid use disorder present in the breast milk. That is not what confers the benefit, because we see the same thing with like, or similar effect from just skin to skin or, you know, somebody else's breast milk. So it's really the attachment and the, you know, bonding and the soothing that contribute the benefit. So yes, strongly encouraged.
And what else do you think about, like, in this immediate postpartum period, what's going to set her up for success otherwise?
Well, this is somewhere a failure, I think, of obstetrics and gynecology as a field, right? Reproductive health is life course. Addiction is a chronic condition, but generally speaking, reproductive health care, in particular pregnancy care, is episodic. So there's a mismatch between providing episodic care for chronic conditions. We provide care, people do well. We withdraw care, they don't do as well. It's not, and we say sometimes, oh, that's the natural history of the illness, right? Addiction is a chronic, recurring, you know, condition. It is, but it's also reflects the fact that we only provide episodic care. So what would care look like? What would addiction look like, I mean, if we actually provided life course care? So what's important is the continuation of care, in particular through the postpartum period. And there are lots of vulnerabilities. There are, you know, mood changes. It's a time where people, you know, you go from frequent weekly contacts with your healthcare system to one postpartum visit, maybe. Care shifts from being focused on, you know, the mother to being focused on the infant, if at all, and generally shifts away from healthcare settings, WIC, home visiting. There's all these sort of public health pieces that are in that postpartum period that are not well connected, if at all, touching, you know, formal, like, you know, healthcare. It's also a time of insurance churn, you know, even for people like who have, you know, work-based insurance, which is what we have in the United States to a large extent. If you need to stay home longer with your kid, if you want to stay home longer with a kid, you might lose your coverage, right? At many states, there's been an expansion of states that have expanded Medicaid and or at least expanded the postpartum care, but that does not always mean people get care because we confuse health insurance with health care too often. Right? Just because you have health insurance doesn't necessarily mean you have care. Sometimes the denominator of, you know, eligibility changes in the postpartum period that varies by state, and there may not be providers, and much less providers that are welcoming of a postpartum person and their baby in their office. Think about what traditional addiction treatment looks like. It is a system built for men. And it is not welcoming of pregnant or parenting people, much less their children. So it's continuity of care is the key thing.
Yeah. So I think it's important for us to really use our interprofessional teams to really help build this continuity of care. And I think we could listen to, you know, talk all day on this topic, but for time, I think we just want to be conscious of it. And I was wondering, could you give us a couple of take-home points that you want our audience to leave with today?
Yeah, I think I wrote down three. The first is, I think in this space of drugs and pregnancy and stuff like this, that we tend to grossly overstate the risks of in utero chemical exposure and minimize the importance of the caregiving environment. The second is related to that. What I would like to see from the field is really a shift from a focus on drugs to a focus on early childhood development. And it's not just for kids who are substance exposed. It's for everybody. So the only way I think that we get the discrimination and stigma out of this space is by universalizing early childhood development. Everybody can benefit from all, like, home visiting, early Head Start, you know, those sorts of things can be very beneficial to everyone, not just, you know, kids who are substance exposed. So to try and shift the focus from drugs to development, from in utero to caregiving environment. And finally, I mean, I think we have to stop, like, policing pregnant and parenting peoples, and to recognize, like, our complicity as healthcare providers with policing and surveillance systems, and that these systems produce oppression and perpetuate, you know, intergenerational, like, trauma, and that we have to, you know, do more than assess and treat. We have to really think about how to literally empower, you know, the people that we serve, to partner with existing, you know, community-based organizations, to stand up and support, you know, the voices of people in recovery, and to integrate them into the work that we do, so that you know, we can build up those communities. And I think this really somewhere simply, you know, begins by interrupting our over-reporting to child welfare.
Amazing. Yes. And do you have anything else that you would like to plug before we sign off?
It can be anything. Something fun, something you want to advocate for, whatever you want it to be.
I will say that with Sarah Roberts and I have a grant to develop self-directed videos and other sorts of content for health professionals to reduce over-reporting. And that I'm hopeful will be available before the end of the calendar year.
Wonderful. And please send that along to us when you have it so we can post it out. It just sounds like a resource that would be helpful for a lot of folks.
Yeah. Yeah. The name of the project is Doing Right by Birth.
Well, thank you again for coming on our show today. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I didn't realize how quickly the time went.
Flies by. Flies by when you're having fun.
And we will be back with our lightning round.
Hi, Mishka. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is the lightning round where we will ask you some rapid fire questions to get to know you better. So can you give us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Oh, gosh. I would say I don't like one-liners. I don't like roller coasters. I don't like party games, but I actually do like fireworks.
What's your favorite type of firework?
Any type of firework.
Are you somebody who likes to go to the big shows, or are you more of a, I like to do it at home and throw a party? Okay.
I enjoy a good firework display, and I enjoy doing fireworks and teaching, well, my nieces and nephew how to like safely light things on, you know, that explode.
Safety counts, you know, for sure. Mm-hmm. We definitely want people to do risky things safely. So do you have a favorite aspect of working in the field of addiction medicine?
Oh, definitely the people that we serve. I think the reason, when I really think back about why I do the work I do, it's because I really enjoyed, when I was in medical school and even before then, you know, working with people who use drugs. Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, you know, I know your background is as an OB-GYN, like how did you kind of come to this field of addiction?
You know, the answer to that question has changed over time. The short answer, the way I say it now, is like when I was a medical student, I worked in a syringe exchange. I set up a medical student volunteer clinic that ran concurrent with a syringe exchange. And then I also really enjoyed OB-GYN. So my career kind of became trying to bring those two interests together.
Well, for this episode, we're so glad you did.
And I agree. I think we hear again and again from all of our guests, it's about the people we serve. You know, it's just really rewarding and wonderful and an honor, you know, to get to do the work that we do on a daily basis.
Without a doubt.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/addiction.
We are committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. A special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Paul Williams for their support in this project, as well as ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about the organization at acam.org. A special thanks to our entire team and our editor for this episode, Kento Sonoda, and to our whole team. The Curbsiders is produced and edited by the team at Podpaste.
And a reminder that this and most of our episodes are available for free CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is make an account. And until next time, I've been Dr. Carolyn Chan.
And I've been Kat Mullins. Thank you so much for joining us today and for letting us bring you some addiction medicine pearls.